Mini episode 1838 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1838. You have with you here today two FDH Lounge dignitaries, Rick Morris and one of our favorite dignitaries, Ben Chu. Ben, most of the time on the show in his capacity as FDH Hoops Analyst, sometimes on with us to talk about the streaming biz. We have a nice little mini series that we've been doing over a period of time, and that may touch somewhat into, I think we'll talk a little bit about the business considerations of our subject today, which is a spoiler-free review of the movie Mountainhead. It is the most successful HBO original films release in 6 years. You have to go back to 2019 to find one that had the next best set of numbers. Mountainhead, so when I say spoiler-free, we're going to give you enough information about the movie. If you've heard about it, if you're kind of on the fence, if you're kind of like, what's this thing about? What do these guys have to say? I like to think that over a period of time, we've built up a trusted reputation here for giving good reviews on things here. We're going to give you our thoughts on this and not do it in a way that's going to spoil your experience if you haven't seen it yet. By the same token, I think we're going to walk that tight walk of, I think, if you've seen it, I don't think you'll be disappointed by what we have to say, because we will have some observations about it. And these will be things I think that will ring true, I'm hoping, for those that have seen the movie, and will strike a chord there as well. So, Ben, great to get you in here. Thank you for recommending the movie to me and for suggesting this segment, and both very much winning ideas on your part.
Oh, yeah, it's been a while since Succession ended. So this is going to the first major piece from Jesse Armstrong. So it's an interesting look, because we always know, based off of the timeline of Succession, he has his own interesting takes on the world.
Yes, he does. And this is a real Masters of the Universe kind of a deal. So it is a fictional story of four tech giants, but it feels like it's ripped from the headlines. It's something where it's very much, as far as the subject matter in it, it's very AI heavy, because it is the story of, and essentially the characters in here, they are stand-ins for some of the major tech giants in the world. The only one that I know that lines up exactly here, as far as what it is supposed to be, that the whole website of Tram, I know that is supposed to be a stand-in for X/Twitter. And this Ven Parrish, who runs it, I know that he is supposed to be the stand-in for Elon Musk. The other figures in this, I don't know as much about who they're supposed to correlate to in the quote-unquote real world.
There were some rumors that the initial storyline was based upon a meeting in, I believe it was in Utah, or in Colorado or Utah, I don't remember the exact one. Mm-hmm. I think it was Reed Hastings was meeting a head group of CEOs and owners at 1.2. I don't think Reed Hastings is anything specific in this, but
okay,
there was some inspiration from a meeting that had took place in Park City, Utah, with essentially Reed Hastings and a group of powerful individuals at some point. So again, I don't think anyone specifically, but again, also to Rick, it's not really surprising that this was going to be part of it, because obviously the whole Elon Musk thing was a huge story over the last couple of years now. And I think, knowing Jesse Armstrong, he was going to have his own take on it on some level.
Yes. And so this is a very worthy post-Succession project for him. And it sails in exactly the same lane as Succession. I mean, the one thing that I feel safe in saying, I know you agree with this based on our conversations, if you love Succession, you're going to love this movie. This is going to be something that will help kind of whet your appetite coming out of that. And it involves a weekend at the fictional Mountainhead, based on, of course, Fountainhead from the Ayn Rand novels. But that is a thing where one of the characters in here, the guy who is supposed to be the cheapest of the bunch here, Hugo Super Van Yalk, who only has $521 million. He's the sole non-billionaire out of this group. He invites them there to his very nice mountaintop retreat, and it's ostensibly, it's a social get-together among old friends. They're reuniting. These are folks who go way back and are very intertwined over a period of time. But, of course, there's all the kind of motives that everybody has here. Everybody's looking to get something out of this weekend. And the one thing that I will say, the one character in here who has some of the best dialogue, I would say, Steve Carroll as Randall Garrett, who is a very, very wealthy investor in some of these companies. So he's a guy who makes his money investing in some of these ventures and other ventures out there. His dialogue more so than anybody else's, but it's a thing where you're looking at it and it's like you feel like with Jesse Armstrong that maybe he had a bag full of Roman Roy dialogue that he never got to use, and it all gets unloaded here. If you loved listening to Roman Roy riff cynically, you'll love this movie because Carol's character more than anybody else, but all of them to some degree. You know, lines like, Earth was a great starter planet, but let's see what else. Let's see if we can do any better than that. I mean, things, and I'm paraphrasing it badly, but the dialogue in there, so reminiscent of Roman, and that's one of the great parts of the movie.
And I mean, the big thing too is that we know Steve Carell can handle any sort of role at this point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like I said, when I was watching, I made the joke to you off air via text. It was like, this is smarmy Steve Carell at its finest.
Yes.
And it's also, I mean, the big story of this point of this real movie too is to talk about sort of that sort of tech bro generation in a way. And also just talking about how we're seeing the consolidation of a lot of money and power in today's society. Right. And we'll get to this in terms of plot later in the movie, but it feels like to me that this is sort of the baseline of the Silicon Valley bro type, but you're also dealing with people who have achieved financial wealth on the insane levels. So their own viewpoints they're allowed to be more free with their viewpoints in terms of any other scenario, because when you're worth that level of capital, it doesn't really matter. Your opinion is going to be your opinion at the end of the day.
Exactly. And the other character that I hadn't alluded to, the main one out of the four main characters, I should say, is Ramzi Youssef's character, Jeff Abradazzi. He plays the character who is the owner of Bilter, which is something that is good at being able to find the fakes in AI and is able to help substantiate essentially what is real and what is not. And as far as this being ripped from the headlines in many different ways, I think I alluded briefly before to AI, but at the time of this weekend, this is where Tram, again, the X stand-in, is being besieged by a whole bunch of deepfakes, that there's been some kind of AI patch that's been put on the site here, giving all these tools to people, and it is fueling any number of disastrous things all over the world. There are things that are alluded to, events that are happening in the United States, a whole lot of things internationally, a whole lot of war-type scenarios and financial, at least borderline meltdown scenarios, all these disasters coming out of the deepfakes here. And this Bilter, the guy that's got Bilter, he's got the key to this thing. So it's a lot of cat and mouse between the characters here, because obviously the guy who owns Tram would like to get his hands on those tools. But the guy that owns those tools, he's getting richer and richer and richer as people lose faith in Tram. So it's a real push and pull. And it really kind of takes a turn between them later on in the movie. And again, this being spoiler free, we won't get into the specifics on what happens between them, nor how that turns out. But the AI thing is one of the things that makes it ripped from the headlines as much as anything else, as well as what you were saying about the tech bro part of this thing here. You look at it in the last year or so with Peter Thiel and some of the people in Silicon Valley, where a lot of them, and I'm going to, you know, say this without really, you know, trying not to make a political point or anything like this, but the way the mogification of a lot of the tech bros in the last year or so has been sort of a mask off moment as far as some of the phony liberal platitudes of years past. Essentially, they're not even pretending. Now, and I'm a guy to kind of find some of that to be refreshing, to be honest with you. Like, you know, I'm not in favor of people pretending not to be scumbags. If they are scumbags, be who you are. But however you see that, however you see these characters in real life, they're mirrored this way. Jesse Armstrong just milks all the subject matter expertly as far as the whole tech bro ethos and everything that we've been seeing over the last 6 to 12 months in America.
And I mean, the real question now is that we've seen, at least just in general, the political landscape move more towards the center or more towards the middle than where there was a run, or not necessarily a run, but a timeline of the Democrats during the Obama administration and the Biden administration, where it was more hyper-focused on liberalism and ideals. But at the same point, too, the question we bring up, and you brought this point overall, is that for a lot of these companies, after we saw a lot of the DEI stuff push back, the discussion point was everything just platitudes at the end of the day? Were these just things that we like to do, or do we actually want to do them at the end of the day? So it's going to be, this is what brings this up in part of the movie. And it's also sort of the interplay of the consciousness of an owner or a CEO for any of that. This is what you're presenting out to the world. But again, you have that, it's the same. This was brought up in a couple of very notable books regarding Mark Zuckerberg, about how his own individual want of growth for Facebook was a lot more, you know, was a lot more focused for him than some of the things and issues that they were dealing with at the time, in terms of deepfakes, in terms of, you know, violent videos, in terms of, you know, accusations by others, you know, spam issues. So, I mean, it's part of the culture, especially within the social media tech world that we live in right now, where the discussion is always, we want to be able to protect everyone we have, but we also do not want to hamper anyone's individual free speech at the same time.
Yes.
Whether it's positive or negative at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah. And as far as the concepts of free speech and how they're utilized, that is kind of a through line in this movie as well, particularly as it relates to taking these tools with the AI tools and what you put out there, and the whole almost kind of nihilistic point of view of this Ven Parrish who owns Tram, of basically saying, you know, let it all happen. You know, it'll all sort itself out. Everything will go the way that it needs to go. He has this almost sociopathic faith in that is going to be, yeah, everything's going to work out. He's like, because to give into the sense of believing that these things have consequences, i.e. reality, if you start to give into reality, then it becomes too much. And there's a certain amount of denial over three of the four characters here. It's interesting that Jeff, the owner of Bilter, his point of view on this being a little bit different and being kind of horrified and a little bit wide-eyed as some of these events start to unfold globally as they are following them through the course of the weekend. The others start to feel that maybe he's a little bit kind of soft almost for having a conscience, for believing that there are ramifications to this. So when you're talking about the different genres of this movie, obviously black comedy is right about at the top of the list, drama as well, because of the ramifications of it. And the dramatic overtones really pick up a lot in the last third of the movie or so. I will say that. But also, I would say this sort of kind of dystopian, it doesn't feel, I mean, it's not a horror movie in any type of classic sense of the word. But if you take it, maybe alt horror or something like that, in a way of like, it's certainly not a standard horror movie, but the ramification of these world events and as they're coming in and processing that and processing the bloodshed, the financial ruin, all these things that are happening, It's horrific. Now you're watching them sort of glibly deflect a lot of this, and you're laughing in a way where when they're making these cracks, like, I can't believe I'm laughing at this. I'm a horrible person, but you laugh anyways. But you're laughing because you know on a certain level there's real horror there that these three of these four characters are completely oblivious to. They've willed themselves to be oblivious to the horror, but the horror is there nonetheless. And you feel that as the viewer watching that and digesting what the ramifications would be if it happened in this world.
Right. And I think one of the leading questions that this movie also presents is that where is the mindset of a lot of these CEOs or high level, because we've discussed this in the entertainment industry and in sports with ownership and general managers, that it's a very ego-driven narrative. And a lot of this movie is discussing what is the, you know, do you need to have a moral compass at the end of the day to make decision-making, or is it more just about the growth of an industry or the growth of a company, or is this more just the whole interplay during the show, during this movie, excuse me, is... It starts out in the beginning of sort of just tech bro weekend and then starts to devolve from there. And then you also have to deal with the process of all these things on the exterior of the world are happening. But at the same point, to these gentlemen, they are as far away from it as humanly possible, almost in like a Shining type house almost. They're away from the world. Like they, you know, if the world ended that day, they would still be okay. Like they would just all be together in that same moment. I think the question too is, and again, this is sort of brought up at the tail end, more in the tail end than it is in the beginning, is that it's good to have a moral compass at the end of the day. I think we all believe in that. But then also, what is the price of things in life? And, you know, what is the price of growth? And we saw this multiple times within the tech community. And it's a very interesting scenario that Armstrong is commenting on in this case, because we tend to, when we view a lot of these tech CEOs, like they're larger than life. But then again, they act and probably deal with same situations just like we all do on our everyday lives. So,
yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things too, where you, and a lot of the way that you view these characters, it's very interesting, because more than a lot of other movies, you may sort of, it will be like your own personal lens that you're looking at this through. There are people who just have this kind of, I guess I'll be judgmental in saying it, but this shallow kind of aspirational thing of, that's who I want to be, damn it. I want to make $1 billion and bang all the supermodels. So people like that are going to view the characters in this movie as despicable as their worldviews are, as being aspirational. And then there's other, it depends on what your prism is as well. And I go back to years and years and years ago, the whole thing when I was going through the CCD class when I was younger here, which that those of us would go to for, those of us didn't go to Catholic school, but would still have the continuing education here leading up to our confirmation. And somebody, one of the teachers one time trying to make the kind of pragmatic kind of argument to folks of like, well, you're going to live what, 70, 80 years, whatever, versus eternity versus. So you look at, if you look at it that way, if that's a view that you've absorbed as I have, that's a thing where these guys are going to live as long as they're going to live, whatever. But all four of these guys, I mean, even Jeff, who's supposed to be the good guy of the bunch, relatively speaking, all four of these guys objectively are on a rocket sled to hell. There's just no question about that as far as their worldview. So you want to live as long as you can live and make the most of it, I guess, if that's the case. And some of that informs Steve Carroll's character's worldview, where I guess he's trying to look at it as a way of like, well, I can't go to hell if I don't die. And it starts to get into a little bit of transhumanism here. In terms of, because he has a very serious form of cancer, he's not getting good diagnoses at this point, not getting good outlooks and everything like that. So one of the reasons he's trying to latch on to Tram is the sense that, oh, if this thing works out, then my consciousness can live forever. And I'll kind of be alive whether or not I still have a body. So you're even getting into transhumanism in the course of this movie here. And somebody who's lived this kind of despicable existence such that he can say these things that are very, very funny, but just shows you, I mean, the guy has no soul whatsoever. No soul, no empathy. He's a sociopath. It's very clear. And that basically this is his way of trying to duck out of the whole thing of what happens to me when I die. Well, you can't go to hell if you never die. And that might as well be that guy's ethos.
Right. And I think one of the things that also just gets brought up in this movie is the discussion of like masculinity in these days.
Yes.
Too, because we've seen, you know, after the Me Too movement, we've seen a shift more in the bro culture than we've ever seen before.
Yep.
And I think on top of that too, one of the big things it's brought up in terms of this sort of ethos within when we build social media. Like, remember, Facebook essentially was a pass or smash app
to be. Yeah. Yeah.
And then we looked at stuff like X was another thing that was discussed and dealt with. Like, it essentially was built off of a podcast narrative. So You're just, I think it's also sort of Armstrong's sort of look also on society about discussing about, we see rich people or people who have a lot of money and we think they're either smarter than us or that they are more remarkable at doing what they do. And certain when you, there are individuals out there for sure that live up to that expectation. But Then as you can guess, in life, there are a lot of unremarkable people who have no real great worldview, but have made money along the way. So it's
right.
It's one of those questions you ask. And I think the movie does ask this too, is that where do we stand with, you know, if you have all the money in the world, essentially what your the major discussion point for this movie is that where do you want to end up? And at one point in this movie, like with the world starting to break down a little bit, one discussion this as well, how can we use this to our advantage? And I think on our level as just normal everyday people, we're a little horrified by that because When we see that level of chaos, we usually bring in empathy. But I, at least outside of, you know, the character played by Remy Youssef at this point, the other three don't really have a lot of empathy through most of this movie. So
no, they don't. And it just is, it's fascinating to watch through that prism. And that, to your point on that, as events start to get more and more dire, such that eventually at some point, and again, this being spoiler free, I won't get into the specifics of it, but there is a call from the President of the United States appealing to one of them to make some type of action. And as far as what comes of that, you'll have to watch the movie to see. But as you're watching all of them grapple with this, it then gets to the whole thing of, and maybe it's a subconscious thing that they all come to, the realization that sometimes the best defense is a good offense, because then it comes to, how can we make this work for us? And it becomes a thing where one of them eventually gets on a conference call with a South American country, basically trying to facilitate a takeover. Like, one of you could be my front man, but I like to swoop in and help kind of manage the chaos and take advantage of the situation. Like, they're getting to circumstances where, and they're even contemplating about the United States government of like, what would it take to really get full throttle control of this thing? Is there an opportunity in this kind of chaos to really grab the entire world by the throat? And you're just seeing them spitball it. And it's starting to become more and more concrete as they're talking about these ideas and then seeing what comes of the ideas. It's just, it's unbelievable. It's the kind of thing where the genius in Jesse Armstrong writing a movie like this is, all of us probably, I mean, we might not have realized this beforehand, right? But we've all probably imagined to ourselves, if you put four masters of the universe like this in one room, and particularly in a scenario where there's a bunch of world crises things happening, this is what they would sound like. I don't know that I ever necessarily intuited that before, but watching it feels completely natural. Of course, if you had, you know, the real world, you know, you have the fictional Elon Musk here, but if you had the real Elon Musk and three other titans in a room, of course this is what they would sound like. Of course.
And I think, too, one of the big questions that, but not necessarily it's a question, but one of the big things that I think Armstrong's asking us, looking at us to ask is that, is and again, we're also, when we also talk about tech bro culture, also we're in the deification of people's society. So
yes,
you're going to have people who will believe anything you say and follow you to the ends of the earth. And I think one of the points that later on in the movie, and I don't think it's really a spoiler, but one of the only female characters played by Hadley Robinson,
mm-hmm.
the discussion is she, as Rami Youssef's character, she's going to go to a party, and then essentially he sends, you know, people to watch her. And the whole question is that he may have the question is, you ask for his character, is like, he may have empathy and a heart, but at the end of the day, is he really that much better than these people? Like, perceptionally, you have the empathy of like, well, he feels bad about this, but he's also on the same level, Turek, willing to have armed guards keep an eye on his girlfriend to essentially what was alluded to earlier in the movie is, oh, she's going to a sex party.
Right.
So it also starts, and again, I feel like also too, you know, I think credit where credit's done. I think Corey Michael Smith did a great job as Ben Pear, essentially, in this movie. And you begin to ask the questions that, for everyone's different faults in the movie, is anyone better or worse than anybody else? And I think that's one of the questions Succession also got brought up a lot. So, should we be shocked that Jesse Armstrong decided to go that route? No. But it's really interesting that this was a movie that was more fleshed out in a very short period of time, but he was able to create these characters with very sort of definable worldviews in comparison to Succession, which was a show that ran for a serious period of time.
Sure. And you raise a really interesting point here, because it is sort of the dichotomy, the Jeff character here. It's something that I don't know if I would say that most of us have, but a lot of us have, and I'm one of the people that has that, in terms of a dichotomy, in terms of, you know, sort of like a worldview versus a micro level view. Like in my case, you know, I will say that again, you know, some of my political thoughts like that, these are things that perhaps some people might find a little bit harsh or anything like that, as far as, you know, I'm essentially, you know, a pretty small government guy and pretty kind of unyielding on that. I am somebody that on the micro level, it really is kind of a bleeding heart kind of a person when you're looking at individual type situations. And I see a lot of the opposite sometimes too. And I don't know, you know, I don't think me or the opposite of me would be entitled to point at hypocrisy at the other person. I think that's just the way it is. But sometimes the people that are the biggest bleeding hearts on a writ large level are not as much on a micro level. And I think that's a little bit of what Jeff is here, because he's a guy where out of the four, like I said, comparatively, he's the nice guy. But he's also a guy where, again, he's having his woman tailed at a sex party and everything like that. Also, too, it's a weird kind of, is it a cuckery kind of a situation that he's even, quote unquote, letting her go to this thing in the first place? That's a whole can of worms in and of itself here, too, of where I think it's supposed to imply that it's a committed relationship, is it not? And yet she's going to this sex party, so there's that raises questions
again,
there as well.
We also need to define, too, Rick, it's what Jeff's character essentially says is a sex party, and then Hadley Robinson's Hester character essentially says, like, no, it's a party where people are having sex.
And that's...
So it just provides it, I just find, especially since it's a spoiler where we can't reveal anything.
Yeah.
It's more in terms of... I find it very interesting that it almost counterbalances his character later on in the film.
Yeah. And for those of us that went to college, you know, as far as, you know, a party where people are having sex, that's just what you call a party, essentially. So, yeah. So is that the whole thing? It's an interesting question there, too.
I just find it interesting because he defines it as that early on.
Yes. And that,
and then later on in the, and then later on in the movie, he, when he's dealing with the situation that's broiling over between him and his friends, he seems very flipped the other way, where there's a little bit of control he had in that situation, but later on in the movie, he doesn't have much control.
Well, this is what I love with the spontaneity of doing segments like this, is when, and particularly when the other person will stir a thought in me that I didn't have before. This is a thought that just popped into my head here, and that is the reliable narrator syndrome. Because as far as when the world events are happening, and the fact that he's the only guy that feels at least somewhat horrified by these things that are happening as a result of the deep fakes and the destruction that is wrought by them, he's the reliable narrator. But on a micro level, is he the reliable narrator? he says sex party, but you just raised a very interesting point there too, that, yeah, that, I mean, he probably isn't a reliable narrator when it comes to the things happening in his own life. He can see the rest of the world more clearly than the other four. And that is a thing that, again, may or may not disadvantage him. We'll let you kind of watch the movie to see as it goes along. The fact that he's an outlier from the group, we can say without fear of spoilers, that's going to build towards something. The fact that the other three are seeing the world one way, he's seeing the world another way, we are building towards that as the movie goes along. But as far as, again, in his own life, is he a reliable narrator or not? Good call on your point for even making me think about that, Ben, because you're absolutely right that just because he's the reliable narrator when it comes to the rest of the world, it doesn't mean that it isn't, he is in his own life.
Right, and I mean, it, again, this is why Jesse Armstrong is such a great writer of character dialogue. We saw it in Succession, and we see it in this movie about, while everyone in this film has moments of just niceness and clarity, but you also get to see that pretty much, and this is a sort of Masters of the Universe scenario, and whenever you run into roles like this, they're always going to be unlikable characters.
Yeah. And one of the things I've seen in some of the reviews is that it does seem kind of unfair, I think, to give the movie a negative review for these reasons, although reviews are subjective inherently so. But the thing of, like, who'd want to watch a bunch of a-holes like this for a couple hours, a bunch of evil a-holes? Like, I don't know, man, because it's like, I don't like to be bummed out by stuff either, but it's like, it's Jesse Armstrong takes it and makes it entertaining. Like, I at no point during the movie did I feel really bummed out about the state of the world, and that's because Jesse Armstrong's a genius. Because if you dwell on that stuff too long, if you dwell on the unlikability of the characters, yeah, you're going to talk yourself out of enjoying this movie. But if you just kind of take it for what it is, I mean, I kept getting, I was texting you as I was watching it. I watched it after you did. And I'm like, oh man, this just keeps building and building here. And it's just like, I was just fascinated watching it go along. Like, it just, I think that people who are looking at this, like, I don't like the movie because I can't root for any of these characters. I don't know. It just feels kind of killjoy to me to say something like that, because it's not always necessary to identify with anybody. Did any of us really identify that strongly with anybody in Succession? And Succession was still awesome. Those were a bunch of awful people, but it entertained us for four seasons. Jesse Armstrong has a history of being able to do this. And then previously, like with the movie In the Loop that he did, and the sitcom in Britain that was based off of, I forget the name of it.
That was Peep Show, to my knowledge.
It was Peep Show's one of the ones that he did.
Yeah,
but it was.
I'm just trying to think.
I'm going
to
bring it up too.
That was the thick of it, right?
The thick of it. Yeah.
He was also famed for writing Fresh Meat as well. Also very.
Yeah. Great. The thick of it is. I recommend that, and then the quasi spinoff movie, which was what was the name of that one again? I just said it.
I believe that was In the Loop.
In the Loop. Yes. In the Loop. My bad. So those are based on characters in the British Parliament. It's sort of a political comedy kind of a thing here. And if you watched that, there were few to know characters in that were really truly likable, but you were just enthralled by it. And those being shows that were kind of like dark comedies, you had a lot of that. You had a lot of the witty dialogue, and you were laughing along with it. Like, Jesse Armstrong swims in these waters. You don't go into a Jesse Armstrong project, and I guess that's my point here. You don't go into this saying, I can't wait to identify with all these morally upstanding characters. Like, you're doing it wrong if you're approaching any Jesse Armstrong project in that way. It's a thing where he will throw some of the most unlikable people at you, and you will still be entertained because they're funny, because their amorality is funny, he makes it so, and because it's just the events that they are involved in are so gripping. That, like, if you go into this like, I don't like it because there's no good guys, I'm sorry, as a reviewer, you're doing it wrong if it's a Jesse Armstrong project.
Right, and another film that, you know, he helped co-wrote is also in the same line with Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, called Downhill. Essentially, that was a married couple. That was a movie about a married couple who went through a near-death experience and just had to also reevaluate their own life. So a lot of the stuff that Armstrong does is that he's not really focused on the mentally, you know, he's more focused on the characters with morally gray areas than anyone else in recent memory. Because I think if we look through, maybe the only other person who's really kind of even in this field would be Mike White of all people.
Right.
So it feels like Armstrong does a very good job at skewing the rich and skewing, you know, individuals who have high sense of morality or a high sense of self. Mm-hmm. And what he's really good at is essentially building storylines, building plots that are really interesting to someone who likes these sort of things, or at least wants to sort of look at the human condition, because it feels like a lot of the content out there right now doesn't really talk about the human condition that much. We're more focused in on genre TV, or more focused in on, you know, mysteries or other things like that, where it's more about the characters, what is happening to the characters, than it is the characters' actions and opinions.
Sure. And for anybody, if there's anybody checking out this review that's a little bit less familiar with Jesse Armstrong, and you're getting much of what you're learning about him from what we're saying here, I'm going to point this out as well, that this is where I can't think of any other writers that are like this. I'm sure that there are a bunch of them. I just can't think of any. But I think of him as sort of the writer equivalent stylistically to either Will Ferrell or Danny McBride. When you catch any of their projects, you know you're getting a Will Ferrell character, even if it's a fresh character that's coming on the scene for the first time in a movie. You basically know what you're getting with Will Ferrell. You sure as heck know what you're getting with Danny McBride when he's got a new show coming out on HBO. I mean, he's had, I think it's now four different series where it's variations of the same guy. He's in different settings. There's some shades that are different, whatever. But like Jesse Armstrong, you know it's going to be amoral people that are funny, that are caught up in compelling circumstances. Like, he as a writer has this same kind of wheelhouse as the other guys. And that sometimes people will use wheelhouse as a way to diminish anybody. I sure don't mean that, because Jesse Armstrong, I think he has a limitless imagination. I think he could sit here for the next 50 years, if he lives that long, and probably keep churning out copy like this that we'll keep coming back to and enjoying. I don't think he's limited in his imagination of what it would be. But everybody's got those areas that they're more comfortable in. And his whole thing of amoral characters who are funny, who are caught up in compelling circumstances that kind of leave you on the edge of your seat, he does that very, very, very well.
Yeah. And again, like, I feel like almost like when you people, like you said, too, like people say wheelhouse, that's usually a bad thing. But that just means very similar to like some of the directors we see in our time, with like Scorsese, Tarantino.
You know,
like they have a specific style and they have a very specific delivery. But at the end of the day, it's better. Like Wes Anderson's another one who's very
right,
has his own worldview and has his own sort of way of setting things up. And it feels like to me is that you can't really discount someone if that's their ability, and their worldview, because I think it's a lot more difficult as a writer or even as a director to be writing sort of these amoral characters.
Yes.
Trying to put them in these situations that the audience cares about, because we're already taught early on in life that we do not want to relate to these amoral characters.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, does anybody out there shred Tarantino for the fact that he doesn't do buddy comedies? No. By the way, Pulp Fiction's not a buddy comedy, if anybody wants to poke at that there. But, no, I mean, we don't have a sense of piling on somebody for something that they don't do. So, yeah, wheelhouse is not a dirty word in my estimation, because, again, if you truly, truly shine at a certain area of life, that's a very exalted thing, I think, critically and a lot of times commercially as well. On the commercial side of this, as we said, best show that or best movie that HBO has put out there in terms of getting people to tune in, best original HBO films picture in 6 years, not since 2019. And you and I were marveling at this off air. This started being written in January, and I was speculating that it may not have gone too far past that, because if you're well enough prepared and you kind of wall yourself in, you can do things in a concentrated period of time, and particularly somebody as talented as him. But it's still remarkable and almost unheard of. I think that they started, I don't know if it was the filming or arrangements or whatever, in March, but then It ends up debuting May 31st. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the turnaround on this was amazing. May 31st is when it comes out, Ben. This has been out now for a little bit of time.
Essentially, if he started this in January, that's less than 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just an unheard of kind of turnaround time. But again, something like this, HBO, they put their faith and their trust in him, and he validated that. And that's the thing where you look at it, and I'm not going to say that they necessarily didn't have any choice, but as we've been seeing over the last week or so here in the media with the cleave off of the assets of the Warner Media empire here, you're not going to have HBO, HBO Max, et cetera, on the one side of things, a lot of the cable channels sort of getting put out on an ice flow here. And as you had pointed out to me off air, that not a whole lot the rest of the year, at least the next part of the rest of the year, as far as original programming on HBO. So they're going to be leaning on something like this and probably pushing it, you know, for a pretty decent period of time here. So hopefully people will continue checking out our review for a decent period of time, because I think HBO is going to be kind of publicizing this for a decent period of time, because A, it's already been a hit as far as how these things have gone, and B, again, they don't have a lot of other things at the moment to be able to point to. It does strike me, I just had this thought now, when we're talking about the best original films as far as viewership in 6 years, that would count the HBO Sopranos spinoff movie, that which is remarkable. That a completely novel movie. I mean, it was something where you knew going into this, you knew with the subject matter, whatever. Okay, this is going to be very Succession-esque. You knew that, but you didn't know any of the characters in that. You had all these Soprano fans that went into it, and a lot of them ended up not liking the Sopranos prequel. That's another story for another day. But to have done better than that one, it just strikes me now, it is surprising for as much run as that was getting.
We also need to note too, Rick, just in all honesty, coming in at like the tail end of spring, is really not the most ideal timeline for a movie like this. Like,
right?
But just for the amount of just for what they were able to do with it, and again, I don't think they're going to put on a full court press. But I think what we're going to see is you're going to start to see it be positioned a lot more on people's watch lists, or at least within the Max coming in with essentially on the top. Or like, again, there are a handful of really good shows right now on HBO Max and Max at this time, but I do feel like there are a lot of people who have the service who watch Succession, and I feel like that there's that initial run of people who love that show who wanted to watch this movie. But I also see it as one of these things that will get rehashed again and again, very similar to like what we saw with Netflix when essentially Squid Game was very popular. Like, they would push that as much as possible to other individuals who had not watched it, if it was in their essentially the algorithm or within anything around those range. So it would not shock me for them. And I mean, I remember seeing it this morning. Like, they'll still keep it on the main title page. It just won't be the first thing you see, but it will be available within like the first couple scrolls.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and you made me think of something else here too when you mentioned about time of year that it came out at, because I immediately started thinking when you said that, you don't tend to see a lot of you know, TV blockbuster movies coming out during the regular blockbuster movie season. You're competing now with, you know, the comic book movies and all the other popcorn fare that's out over the summer. So I started thinking to myself, I quickly Googled this here, The Many Saints of Newark, the Sopranos prequel movie, that I thought I remembered that it was released in the fall. It was October 1st, 2021. Similarly, I remember that, I don't remember the name. El Camino, the Breaking Bad spinoff movie. I remember that was in the fall too. I remember, I think I actually took a day off of work the day that came out. So you don't, you raised an interesting point here. You don't tend to see, you know, TV channels competing with whatever's in the theaters for attention right now. It is kind of striking that they did that in this instance.
Right. And in this instance, too, the last movie that did receive up this level was Bad Education, a movie that was in 2019 with Hugh Jackman and Allison Janney. But I'm going to put a little bit of an asterisk by that, because that was roughly in the same timeline of COVID. So it would not shock me that got pushed into that timeline because of it.
Yeah. So that's true.
But again, like, I agree. It's like, And again, the one discussion, and I think this was, I believe it was either The Ringer or The Hollywood Reporter that brought this up, said we may see a little bit of a mini renaissance with a lot of these streamers now putting together their own original movies and debuting it within this timeline of spring, summer, because they have to know too that once kids are off of school and, you know, the weather gets hotter, there's going to be a lot of instances of people just wanting to stay in their homes in the AC and watch stuff. And a movie like Mounthead, with sort of its premise, is going to be something that you can easily push regardless of the year, because it's not spatially focused in any specific time. Like, there's no, you know, this is not like, you know, this was a specific year, specific time. Like, I think this movie is somewhat timeless in that manner.
Yes, I think so. And yes, Bad Education, that was the movie I was referring to in 2019, that this one surpassed it recently as far as, so again, if you go back, you got to go back 6 years to find one that's even close. And El Camino, I was right. It was October 11th, 2019, that was released. So it tends to be sometimes other times a year that these movies are released. So I think I might have had a little bit of a thought, maybe on a subconscious level, of like May 31st. That's kind of interesting that they would have sent it out then. But I don't think it was until now, when I really started to look at when some of these other notable TV movies have come out, that it is a little bit different to try to, you know, compete for attention with blockbuster movies that are in the theaters right now. So it shows you the amount of confidence, I think, that HBO had in this, that with a Jesse Armstrong project, that people were going to follow it. I think similar to, again, and in this country, probably the majority of people know him from Succession. In Britain, it might be different because of some of the projects that he did there. There's a handful of people like me that became fans of those projects that know him from that as well. But most people probably know him for Succession. And that's where, again, if you hear that it's going to be a Succession-esque project, knowing people's hunger for it, knowing the fact that, again, you talk about shows that, and there aren't a lot of them where people have the consensus that it went out on top. People say that about Seinfeld, because Seinfeld could have gone on a lot longer than 9 seasons and everything like that. Succession only going 4 seasons. And at the time, there were people who were like, isn't there any possible way you could do a 5th season? To which he answered, it was the story of who was going to come next after Logan Roy. So whatever we would do would not be part of that, because the question's been answered. Who comes after Logan Roy and runs Waystar Royco? And that, which kind of left the door open for something to be a spinoff sequel, maybe. I don't think he ever completely closed the door on that, on what happens with the characters. But going out on top with the core franchise, that was a thing where, again, that left people hungry. And that's something where, and again, if we're going to compare it to Seinfeld, there were things where, you know, whether it be the B movie or other things like that, Seinfeld was able to do other projects in the time after that, because people were like, oh, I want something that's going to remind me of Seinfeld. And I think the fact that the B movie and some of these other things didn't get the reviews that were that great was because people were viewing it through that unfair prism. Versus with Jesse Armstrong, he can do these other things that are going to be very reminiscent of Succession. And I think if you and I were to make a prediction on this with anything going forward, that's the lane that he's going to stay in. Because again, we've established this wheelhouse shouldn't be a dirty word, but like, he does this kind of thing so good. And he's probably got so much more that's locked up in that head of his, that if he can get this out into the world here, he can just keep churning out things like this for as far as the eye can see. And as you said to me off air, boy, wouldn't HBO love to have that be the case, because they're going to need it in the years ahead.
And I mean, one of the big questions too, Rick, as we just know in terms of, like, I guess one of the people in this sort of television arc that I would compare like Armstrong's narrative to is Charlie Booker, obviously, from Black Mirror. And There's always going to be content for individuals like them, because There'll always be something they can satirize. There's always something that is happening in the world of technology. I know there was also, when Mountainhead was being made, there was also a lot of discussion too. He had done some review work of Sam Bankman's Freed, the Michael Lewis book about Sam Bankman Freed as well. So again, it's going to be very interesting to see what is the next sort of amoral, rich scenario that Jesse Armstrong could put together for his, you know, next film. And I think, and ultimately too, for him, probably with Succession going out on top, which as we've seen in all, in the world of TV, comedy, action, it's very hard to not to go out on top.
Yes.
But a way now that he can continue to sustain his sort of legacy overall is these one-off movies that you can create these new characters that people can either loathe or hate or like for whatever reason, you know?
Yeah.
At the end of the day. So it's he set himself up very well with this movie to get another, I don't know the exact terms of his partnership at this time with HBO, but it was very apparent in the marketing for the trailer. He was very out in front.
Yeah, very much so.
Very intentional about putting from the creator of Succession within the trailer within a second or two, which would normally would be a thing that you would mainly be doing for an actor, but in this
right.
case, it was completely different.
Yeah, and I can't say that I know what his exact deal is with HBO. My guess is that it's more or less kind of a handshake deal of you keep coming back to us and, you know, not even pitching stuff, telling us what you want to do and we'll make it happen. I mean, I think he's basically carved his way into that kind of echelon. And that
it goes
it's
with
way-
the timeline too, Rick.
Yeah, exactly.
It's and, in 6 months. It's for any TV movie, that is a very short time span.
Yeah, and that's the thing here too, is that like it allows him to reach, I think, an even wider audience than he reached with Succession, which is one of these things where, and that's kind of notable that like Succession had a lot of the water cooler cachet of Breaking Bad and other shows like that, whilst not matching it in terms of numbers. It was one of those things where the numbers were never quite as high as all the critical buzz led you to believe, and the media attention and everything like that. And that what I attribute that to is that there's a lot of people out there. I know my dad is somebody like that. Like my dad got mad at me when I watched an episode of Better Call Saul with him. Now, this was towards the end, and he's like, now I have to watch the rest of it. Like, there's a lot of people that don't like to invest in things over a period of time. Me and you are not people like that. Me and you will invest in long-term viewing projects here. But there's a lot of people out there. I think there's more people in the world like my dad than there are like us who don't necessarily like to do this. Jesse Armstrong can keep serving up quote-unquote bite-sized Succession from now until, you know, he's no longer on this dusty spinning orb because he's got these ideas in his head. So it's a way to take the whole core idea of Succession and make it in these bite-sized things that people can keep consuming over a period of time. There's not the whole thing. Nobody will ever look at Mountainhead and say, 109 minutes, I can't possibly commit that much time to it. People would look at Succession and say that, even though I think those people
right.
are
and
missing out on
it's something
that
we've definitely seen in TV and movies that have lengthy timelines. Mm-hmm. Like the most notable ones I can think of off the top of my head were stuff like Murder, She Wrote, Frasier, Cheers was like this too, The Office was like this too.
Mm-hmm.
Like these were long-standing series that eventually fizzled down at the end.
Right.
Or went through extended periods of time of just disinterest.
Yep.
So it feels like almost for a writer, very similar for a writer like Jesse Armstrong, like this is kind of having the best of both worlds. Is you're still going to be the guy who created the thing, but
right.
you also have the ability to pursue these other scenarios.
Right.
And because of that initial fame, you're going to be able to keep producing them.
That's right. And you know, when you're doing a project that's 109 minutes long, the thing you don't have to worry about is the equivalent of season 8 of The Office. You know, there's no time in here for a Nelly character that people get sick of immediately. It's only 109 minutes. So it's basically taking it and it's sort of sharpening the idea to the shortest, tightest window that it can possibly be. Because, again, the way that I think me and you and a lot of other people have tried to explain to our friends and family, those that aren't as interested in episodic TV, is it's just like a long movie. It's great. It's like a real long movie. But again, a lot of people don't like real long movies. But this is one where at 109 minutes or whatever his projects end up being from here on in, this is digestible in a way where it allows him to kind of build that following. And even coming out of Succession here, I'm gonna say this. Here's my clip and save quote. He could become bigger than ever in the years to come. He keeps churning them out like this, and he'll be bigger than he was when he was doing Succession because he'll have more of a wide following, I think.
And I think on top of it, too, is that if you look at sort of the things that have become popular, even though it's mainly been TV, there is definitely a field, and we've seen this in the last in the post-pandemic timeline, of these movies becoming big hits for these streaming giants. And it's going to continue because at the end of the day, as we deal with the current state of the economy and people deciding at some point where their value is going to land, the last things, in my opinion, are going to be the things to go are going to be some streaming services because it just provides so much content in most cases for most individuals. So,
yep,
it's going to be one of. And what are the assets that are going to be the tentpole to keeping viewers on that platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, if they can keep getting movies like this out of Jesse Armstrong, and I think it's just a matter of willingness on both sides. Certainly they're going to be willing because they need the content, and if he's willing to keep doing them like this, and hopefully he will be, then we can kind of keep this up as far as the eye can see and have a lot more great things to review over a period of time. Are there any notes about the movie that you were thinking about that we didn't get to yet, Ben?
The one thing is that, and I do feel like, I don't call this a spoiler, but one of the big points of this movie that I don't think we really talked about was initially with the character played by Jason Schwartzman of Super, where he is essentially bringing them to pitch his wellness app.
Yes, yes.
And it's also the discussion of wellness being commodified.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was also another thing. I would love to see him. I would love to see Jesse Armstrong tap into that in a future movie. But that was another thing that it wasn't a main plot point, but it's a discussion point to where we've seen that the popular thing of the timeline right now is health and wellness.
Yes.
But again, if you look on the other side of it, you're seeing these organizations make hundreds of millions of dollars, and we've seen like what Gwyneth Paltrow did with Goop, and what some of these other giant CEOs have essentially created wealth from preying on people's insecurities.
And that's great.
Going to be very interesting to see, because I could totally see a future movie that Armstrong stays within that sort of lane, or we may see something very similar to what we saw with the whole Sam Bankman-Fried, Caroline Ellison scenario too. So that could also be on the table coming up.
That could be. That's an amazing point. That really is an amazing point by you, Ben, because when you get into this, it really is one of these circumstances where, there are no sacred cows out there for somebody like Jesse Armstrong. He's not going to be afraid to take an industry like this and say, look at the amount of, phony sentiment that there is. This thing's been commodified top to bottom. They're talking about all these ways to make a better, more peaceful world, a more gentle world in terms of mental health. But it's all about putting money in somebody's pockets, or too often it ends up being that way anyway. So that's an excellent point by you, and one that needed to be brought up as we're talking about this movie, because there's probably a couple different areas that we didn't think of yet, but I think we did the best we could on this. But there's so many different elements to this as you watch this, and I hope, and I do think that we did justice to the movie as we're going through this. I think you'll have an accurate sense of what you're going to be in for as you go to watch this movie, which hopefully you will if you haven't yet. Maybe you'll watch it a second time if you already have. I probably will at some point here. And it's just a movie like this. One of the highest praises that I could give to it would be that it's hard to do justice to it in the course of a review. And yet I feel like we did, Ben Chu.
Yeah, I think, again, this was one of those things. This was not a heavily promoted project, but I have a feeling there's going to be a lot more promotion of this coming soon.
Yeah. On the HBO platform, they were doing a pretty decent amount of it. You're right. Not much in terms of mainstream advertising and stuff but on the TV networks and everything.
Well, and now, no, this is too rigged. Sorry if I'm interrupting. But yeah. We're hitting that. We're hitting summer. And once you hit summer, there's going to be an opportunity for a lot of people to get into a movie like this, especially if the promotion of HBO at this time.
Well, and the thing that's hilarious is, I guess this is a good note for me to leave off on as any, and to maybe preview the next time that you and I are getting into our whole mini-series on the streaming industry, is that you would look at something like this, and all things being equal, you would think to yourself, okay, a year, year and a half out, whatever it's going to be, they'll do a heavily, you know, promoted thing where they sell a bunch of money for advertisements, debut on, say, TBS. They take a lot of HBO projects and move them over to TBS eventually and sell commercials and everything like that. Now, who's to say? Because by the time that time frame comes and goes, you know, like we said before, those cable channels are getting put out on an ice floe somewhere, soon to be separated from the mothership that is Warner Media, HBO, HBO Max, etc. So as far as this actually showing up on any type of broadcast or cable network at any point, I would say don't count on it, because they're going to probably try and keep this to themselves. And I guess that's going to be part of the business model going forward, is make the viewer come to you with talents like Jesse Armstrong and the aforementioned Danny McBride, as we said before. Once he's done with Righteous Gemstones, he'll recycle the character into some other scenario and it'll still be great, et cetera, et cetera. Making the viewer come to them to see these things that are proprietary to them. And as long as they got guys like Jesse Armstrong churning out projects like this, they'll keep me coming back, and probably you as well, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. And I think, you know, it's a very interesting scenario. Like, the big question I think we all have was, what was Armstrong going to be doing after Succession? And this is a good bounce back.
Yeah.
High that he came down from at that period of time.
Yeah, and tapping into that same excitement level that we felt watching Succession. I can think of not much higher praise than that, because Succession, again, I think on the all-time top tier of TV shows, and this is a movie that is certainly worthy of that. We've made a lot of comparisons to it tonight, and I think that's a credit both to this movie, Mountain Head, as well as Succession, for us to make the comparisons. One great movie and one great TV show. And Ben Chu, thank you for being part of one great review of Mountain Head. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1838.